This is Alan Cameron, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 31st of January, 2013. Alan Cameron, Part 1.
Henry Alan David Cameron, 15th of July, 1934.
So you're 79 now?
Yes.
And do I call you Alan?
Yes, I'm called Alan. My first name was inherited from my father, who died 6 months before I was born. And the third name was the choice of a rich aunt who they thought might leave us some money, but never did. But the family called me, wanted to call me Alan, so I've always been known as Alan, except on official things where sometimes you go and they call out Henry Cameron, and I think, another Cameron here somewhere.
Who's he?
Then I realise who it is.
Yeah. So you never knew your father?
No.
Do you know what he did for a living?
Yes, he was a carpenter, ship's carpenter. And he worked for, at the time I was born, he was working for John Players and Sons in Nottingham, where I was born.
So would he have had much of an education, your father, would you say?
Not all that. He was an artisan, shall we say, but I learned very little about him, apart from the fact that he died, we think, of after effects of First World War.
Gas?
Well, possibly, and also he wasn't actually in the trenches. He was in repair base behind the trenches, repairing guns and things like that. And
were you an only child?
No, I was the fourth in the family. My eldest brother's was 20 odd years older than I was. Then I had a sister who's 18 years older than I, another brother. And then I think about, it's been 10 years after that, I turned up one Sunday morning. My siblings say they were sent to church one Sunday morning, and when they came back, I was there. And I don't think my mother knew too much about it either.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh,
God. As far as I can find out, anyway.
Yeah.
So I was sort of generation almost behind the rest.
What sort of education did you have, Alan?
The early education was a bit mixed up because I went to school almost the day war broke out, and I was only in the school for about 3 days when they turned it into a recruitment centre. And then we did a bit of teaching in people's houses for a while. And then I got evacuated outside Nottingham because they thought Nottingham was going to get a beating. So I went to a country school in Plumtree, just outside Nottingham. And then when they saw that Nottingham wasn't getting hit, because I think they set up a mock town further down the Trent, and in those days aircraft navigated by rivers and things like that, and I think that took most of the bombs, so there wasn't a lot of bombing in Nottingham. So I came back and lived with my elder brother and his daughter, who's the same age as I am. That shows. people used to think we were twins, but in fact I was her uncle, so she used to call me uncle when she got annoyed with me. And then I went, came back and lived with my mother. She was a nurse during the war, and there were only the two of us at home. My elder brother wasn't fit to go in the services. My sister and brother were both in, one in the Wrens, one in the Navy. And I spent time in my school holidays staying wherever my sister was. She was in the Wrens on one of these listening stations, listening to Morse codes and sending the details to the place that did the interpretation. So I lived with my brother and went to a school just outside Nottingham, well, Aspley. And then I got a scholarship to grammar school and stayed there, finished up with 3 O-levels, maths, physics and chemistry, technical stuff. And that time at 18 you had to register for national service. And I wanted to join the Navy because we were into boats and things like that. My brother had bought a dinghy just when he came out after the war. So I applied for the Navy, and they were only taking 1% of the people and wanted me to learn Russian, which I didn't. So
sounds a bit ominous.
You move to the next one, so I thought, well, I'll try and get in the AC rescue boats again. And they said, well, you'll have to sign on for 3 years. And as there was only my mother and myself at home, I decided I wasn't going to do that. So they said, oh, well, you'll have to wait. But the army, I think, took 90% of the people. And they said, we can't fit you in for a while. So I got a job temporarily in a toy department of a department store until I got called up in 52.
What were the toys around at the time? Was there Meccano by then?
Well, yes, there was Meccano. And I dealt in the toy department with the trains and the boys' stuff. The rest of the department was all women. So I stayed there until I eventually got called in 52.
Into what?
Into the REME, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers. And I was put on I did 6 weeks basic training. And then I was posted to Arborfield in Berkshire on a 9-month radar, training on radar. I finished that course and they posted. I'd finished fairly high, and so I took another 3-month course for a second class radar mechanic. And then, being in the REME, you get posted all over the little detachments everywhere. And the usual thing was in the final exam, the top 3 people had choice of where they went, choice of the postings. So I worked quite hard, came second. And then they said, ah, yes, but, we're posting the first top 3 in as instructors.
Oh, no.
So I got posted, stayed at Arborfield for the following remaining year as an instructor on radar sets.
How sophisticated was radar in those days?
Well, it was left over from the war. It was getting quite good. It was manual insofar as tracking went. You turned handles to keep the aerial, to follow the aircraft. And that data was fed to anti-aircraft guns to give them a position to aim at, because obviously you have to aim in front of the plane. But they were big machines. Big four-wheel things with the entire transmitter inside. And job as instructor, I had 7 radar sets under my command as a corporal. They made me up to corporal. And you'd have perhaps 4 or 5 students, and you'd put faults on the machine and throw them in there, and they'd write up how they've found the faults, and it's just teaching them techniques of fault finding.
So were you servicing the machines or operating them for radar purposes?
No, they would be used for any aircraft that were around, but basically the training was to get people to repair them in a logical manner. If you have a fault, you don't start at the beginning, work the way through the machine. You start in the middle and work outwards. So we do stupid things like putting little bits of silver paper between two pins on a valve and putting the valve back in, or disconnecting something. So then you go round and they tell you how they found the fault, and generally put another set of faults on the following day of different type for them.
What happened when you when your national service finished? That would be 1954.
Yeah. I then got a job back in my hometown with Ericsson's, who were making the telephone people. But they were making machines for all sorts of types. But there was a proto-production line where they, before they put in things into full production, they'd make a dozen or so. And I was one of three test engineers who would check that the thing was working properly and find any faults, and so that when they got to the final production line, it was a continuous thing.
What do you remember working on in particular?
Well, we did a lot of work on Geiger counters for the atomic research station at in
Harwell.
Harwell, yes. And when the instrument was finished, the Harwell people would come and do a whole series of tests. Some of the machines would take the best part of a day to go through all their tests. And they all had to be done at once. And that's when I ran into trouble with the unions. Because we were staff rather than works personnel, the works came in at 8 in the morning and the staff came in at 9. So if anything went wrong between 8 and 9, there were no test engineers. So the company asked us if one of us could come in to cover that hour. And after about 6 months or so, we got a letter from the union, which was the Association of Scientific Workers, I think it was called, saying we'd been dismissed from the union for working works hours without their permission. So we were a bit upset about that. So they said we could rejoin again, but the three of us decided not to bother, so that didn't stand us in too good stead.
You were getting a bit frustrated, weren't you, with Eric?
Yes. And then I saw this advert in the Daily Telegraph for electronic engineers required to go to Antarctica.
What was the first inclination you had in your life that there might be a place called Antarctica?
Well, I'd obviously remember being read Scott's book at school when I was quite young, and then I took quite an interest in Shackleton particularly. I even remember reading Scott's book a second time at home in the hope that he actually made it back.
And as you can see, you mean the happy ending version?
Well, yes, looking for it. And I just generally got interested. No idea I'd ever go there, but I started collecting odd books on. I've got a top row of those old Antarctic books. Nansen and God knows who.
Were you inspired at all by those stories?
Not unduly. It was just a sort of adventure type things, and I think it must have been in the background when I saw this advert. So I got asked to go for an interview, I think, early in.
So what made you apply? What was the driving force?
just seeing an advert and wanting to get out of this restrictive scenario I find myself in.
You'd worked out that the Antarctic was one of the few places in the world where there were no unions.
Well, after the interview, when they told me vaguely what I would be involved with, I got more interested, obviously, because the IGY was coming up, and this was to be the part of that.
What do you? I appreciate it's a long time ago, Alan, but what do you record of the interview?
Oh, being asked technical questions, the Crown agents, I think there were about four people interviewing me, asking me things like how would I heat up some water if I only had a battery and that sort of...
Oh, real practical stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Talking about what life on base would be like, and it generally was interesting.
Do you remember who was on the other side of the table?
I can't, no.
Don't worry.
It's Crown agents. I don't. There must have been a FIDS representative, obviously.
Somebody called Frank Elliott?
Yes, Frank was involved, I'm sure. And that was early in 57, and I didn't hear, that was about February, I think, 57, I couldn't exactly tell you the date, until I got a telegram early September saying, could I sail on the Shackleton on the 4th of October? Prior to that, they wanted me to spend a week at the radio research station at Slough, where the Ironson machines originated from. And it was quite a busy time because I was supposed to give a month's notice at work. But they were very good. They let me go. I think I got the telegram on a Thursday, and I packed up on the Saturday. Having cleared everything.
What point then do you think in that process you actually got the job? Were you told at the end of the interview that you're...
No, I never heard after the interview anything.
You never heard
until I got this telegram. So I presumed they'd found somebody. So obviously I think somebody docked out at the last minute, and I was a second choice, as it were. But I guess the fact that I would... fairly familiar with small boats and had done a fair bit of travelling during the war. I don't know why they chose me, but they did. So I did this week at Slough, and I had all my teeth fillings removed and insulated and lots of other things to... I told my girlfriend I'd got a job down south, and she said, oh, London? I said, no, a bit further than that.
How did she react?
Well, she was quite happy for me, yes. Yeah, the next time I heard from her was the first mailing base the following summer down south, when they got a letter to say she got engaged to somebody else. So it was the usual Dear John thing, you stick the letter up on the notice board and go and have a few beers.
Were you surprised, upset?
No, well, it wasn't all that serious. She was just a current girlfriend, as it were. But I did name the cat after her.
I'll come to that later on.
Right.
This is Bridget, isn't it?
No, it finished up as Bridget. She was dizzy when I...
Yeah, the woman was called Bridget.
No, she was called Dizzy.
The
girlfriend was called Dizzy, and I named the cat after her when I took it south.
I will come back to that later on.
She got renamed later.
Yes.
When she returned to Stanley.
What do you recall of the journey south, Alan?
Well, the first thing I recall is that the crew went down with Asian flu. And we were all... The Fids never got it. I don't know why it didn't reach that part of the Shackleton. So we were all commandeered into steering the boat, crossing the equator, usual palaver with duckings and things. Very happy group on the boat. There was one summer visitor, a Dr. Blundell from Birmingham, who I used to play bridge with. I got taught bridge on the boat. Fairly uneventful trip down as far as Montevideo.
Were you doing any helmsman work?
We were all, while the crew was down sick, we were doing helmsman and deck scrubbing and generally partying in the saloon on the way down, you know. So it's fairly uneventful as far as till we got to Stanley.
And what happened to Stanley? What did you make of the place?
Stanley, well, it's interesting. I mean, it had... There was only one made-up road between the jetty and the government house, which was laid down for the previous year's visit of the Duke of Edinburgh. I remember the governor's car was a London taxi. All the other roads were rough roads. Visited the odd pub. I think there's only about three in town anyway. And then, of course, all the you were issued with all your gear in Stanley at that time. Had an interview with the governor.
What do you remember of that? Would this be Arrowsmith, was it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, not much. He obviously had a list and knew a lot about you and asked questions, but it was... I think that he was interviewed all the people and then obviously met Set Figs, Fids as was. His name I cannot recall.
Johnny Green?
Johnny Green, yes. Yeah. And then we set off for... I think we went to Georgia first. Can't recall. But we went in and offloaded at Sydney, which was the first base, we called that. And then got stuck in ice, and then the famous iceberg episode occurred.
Tell me what your memories are of that fateful day.
Well, I was sat drinking about 11:30 at night, playing bridge. And we could hear the bangings and crashings as we went through this brash ice. It wasn't all that heavy, I don't think. And then we heard the bosun, I think it was, on the boat walk along and start sounding tanks. And he opened the porthole and poked his nose into where we were and said, "There's 6 foot of water in the hold," he said. "Do you think I should tell somebody on the bridge?" And then a few minutes later, all hell broke loose. The boat. We noticed that the beer in the glasses was sloped against the top of the glass, and she started taking on a list. And thereafter, it was. Boats out. They decided to throw cargo over the side, particularly anthracite, to lighten the boat. And they swung the little tow boat we had for taking stuff ashore over and as far as they could get the crane out, past its normal limit, to heaved the boat over to one side, and then we started throwing stores and trying to get dig down into the hold to get to the lower hold. Quite a hectic time.
Do you remember, first of all, that part of the story about the chap putting his head through the portal suggests that the bridge were not aware of the problem at that point?
Well, I think they'd sent him to
investigate.
I don't know whether they had any indication on the bridge of what how much water there is in the hold or anything like that. But no, it was quite hectic.
Who was in charge? Who was giving you the orders?
Well, the ship's crew. The ship's officers who was on the flak and can't remember the second. Flack was the chief officer. Captain Brown, I think it was the captain. And Woodward was the second officer. Can't remember who the third officer was.
Tom Woodford,
yeah. Yeah.
So just take me through then what you were actually doing yourself at that point. You were with the rest of the FIDs.
In the hold, sort of an hour on, an hour off.
Up to your knees in water? Or?
And beyond, yes.
And beyond.
Yes, at times. Trying to get... They'd found out where the hole was, which was just below the waterline. And obviously they heeled the boat over to stop the water coming in. So we were trying to get... So we could lift... we'd only taken off one set of gear for Signy, and that was in the upper hold. So they needed to get down to the lower hold, which was where the water was, to get to where the hole was.
Did you see the hole?
Yes, oh yes. Yeah.
Was it substantial?
Well, it's a sort of split. It wasn't all that large, I suppose, about an inch wide. But water was obviously splashing in. By that time it was above the water line, but the water was still coming in. And we built a box inside it and started filling it with concrete.
Inside the boat?
Inside, between the outside wall, and there were ribs, and we built a box inside the ribs and started filling it with concrete.
Shackleton was a single hold vessel?
Yes, yeah, well, I think she was double, might have been double hauled at the bow. She was certainly strengthened in the bow.
Yeah.
She didn't have side tanks.
Do you know whose idea it was to use a cement fondue?
Not really. Ship's officers, we knew we had it on board because it was being taken down to do work at Lockroy on the new generator shed. Mm. So anything which was, let's say, expendable but heavy was dumped. Certainly an awful lot of anthracite. And
so it was a human chain gang, was it?
Yes, basically, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you worried at all?
Not unduly. How long it was, probably must have been a day before the Southern Officer turned up, which was a relief to see another boat. She just stayed close by in case we had to evacuate completely. Some of it's a blur because I guess we were all pretty tired.
But tell me about the cement fondue. How successful was it?
Well, reasonably so, except I think it it leaked through to the engine room, as I understood it, and start blocking up the bilge pumps. And I think that later on they found that there was a watertight compartment between the hold and the engine room. Somebody hadn't filled in where a pipe went through, and it was going through there. And I think some of the cement had gone through and was blocking up one of the bilge pumps or something like that.
Did you have to clear that?
Well, I think eventually once we got the boat in calmer water, because I think he was going to head into a cove from one of the islands, but we couldn't get in because it was full of ice. We got the water down, as I recall, and then eventually the protector turned up, I think about several days later. The story I heard was that they were somewhere at a party or something, and the SOS message was picked up by Cape Town and relayed to Portsmouth, who relayed it back to the Falklands, who got eventually the protector sailed and turned up, I can't remember how many days later, and they evacuated us all onto the protector. And they sent across a couple of engineers from Protector who went out. Well, first of all, we tried putting canvas covers over the hold, over the hull, but it was still leaking. And the guys from the Protector came over and shot bolts into the side of the hull, and which had to be done fairly accurately because they then made a plate that fitted the bolts and screwed it on and made a temporary fix, and we limped up to South Georgia.
Do you remember how they sealed the plate?
Well, they put some form of sacking and filled it with something in between and clamped it onto the side. Made it watertight anyway, enough for us to steam slowly up to Georgia.
What was it like in the days... Once you stemmed the flow, so to speak, you then had two or three days, I think it was, before the protector turned up.
Yeah.
In a ship that was at a funny angle. I mean, was life difficult?
Not that I can recall, no, not particularly. I think we, once they'd fairly well sealed it and we were in calm water, there wasn't, the pumps were, getting water out rather than it was going out faster than it was coming in.
Other FIDs who were on the ship at the time reckon you were really lucky with the weather.
We were, yes. Extremely lucky, yeah. But, I mean, being in semi-pack, there wasn't a lot of sea running. It was, that's calmed down once you're in pack ice.
Where did the protector take you?
She took us to Georgia. And then we all went back to live on the boat while she was in dry dock.
In Falklands again?
In South Georgia.
Oh, right, that's the...
She went into a dry dock in South Georgia, which could barely take her, so all the stores were offloaded. And Shackle hung out both ends of this dry dock, but eventually they got her up high enough to repair her properly, but all the stores were totally soaked, and Dave Price, I went down with, who was going to be the engineer on base, had worked with Listers, and these were Lister engines, so he and I and others were involved in washing all the gear and seeing what was good and what was bad, and the massive Lister generators were all in pieces because of you couldn't take them ashore as a whole entity, so they had to be assembled once they got to Lockroy. So they were all reassembled as much as we could on the quayside in South Georgia. Washed everything and dried as much as we could. And
I suppose you were also making sure it was all still there, were you? Because bits could have been dumped.
Well, I don't think anything of that was dumped at all. Because it was in the lower hold and in a different position. I don't think it was in the way of where we were digging stuff out of. but I can't remember how long we were at South Georgia, but quite a long while putting the engines together, finding out what bits were totally useless, like all the switchboard gear was all useless, you know, water in the meters. And, but the listers, they were didn't have a lot of trouble. They were all dried out, and when we finally assembled them, there were some minor problems. But we did have to have a new control board shipped in before we got them going on base.
Thank you very much for that. That's really helpful. It's, yeah, I've talked to several chaps who were there on the time.
Yes,
each account just gives you more information.
Yeah, because it's well recorded in many FIDS articles.
It is, but it was very useful to hear your view as well. I hadn't realised you were up to your waist in water.
Yes, we were quite wet.
Oh, there's a mention of a frogman. Did you remember a frogman called George?
No.
It's
From the Protector?
I guess so.
No, as far as I know, he might have been a frogman, but he was actually hung over the side with a harness on, going in and out of the water while he was putting these bolts in. He may have been a frogman in the Navy, I don't know.
Using a Cox gun to put the bolts in?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
So let's get you to Port LaCroix.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you've been told where you were going.
Yes, well, I knew that from the onset, yes.
But did he have any idea what he'd be like when he got there?
Not really. I think I'd seen a picture of the base somewhere down the line. I can't recall meeting anybody who'd actually been there on the boat going down. I think there were the odd second-time FID on board. I know there were three people who never came back on our particular trip.
Black, Strident.
Strident, Bush.
Statham. And,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'll come to that later as well, if I may. So tell me about Port LaCroix. David Price describes it as a gentleman's residence.
Yes, it was. It was very nice. It was a very small island. That was quite a surprise for me. just above water level, I guess. I don't know how high the island was, but it wasn't very high. We were very busy when we first arrived, obviously. Everything was off, loaded, and we started building foundations. I wasn't involved in any of the scientific work till we'd finished the generator shed and installed the engines. And
so you're building a brand new shed, were you?
Yes. Yeah.
I gather you were partly responsible for laying the concrete floor.
Well, though it was on pillars. I think there were 2 foot square pillars. They all had to be levelled. I was involved in the building, and I actually got a scar on the head. It was an iron frame building with cross struts to support each side. And while we were building it, I was at the bottom of one of the stanchions. And I think Dave Price was up on the top of the stanchion putting in this crossbeam. And he wanted a bolt or something, and somebody threw it up to him, and he let go of the crossbeam, and it came down on my head. And I still have the scar.
No permanent damage apart from that?
Well, people say there was, but I still have a nice scar. You can feel it in my skull. It knocked me out for a few minutes, and I remember we held it together with a bulldog clip, wanted to stop bleeding.
That bad?
Well, yes, it was just bleeding, and we tried to hold the skin together. I don't, it obviously made some dent in the school, but nothing serious.
Was that a close call?
Well, it could have been, but, you know, I, apart from when I do something stupid on base, they say that blow you had, but hopefully it wasn't.
I think you were the craftsman who put the floor in, the tongue and groove floor.
Yes, we were all involved in that. I had some knowledge of carpentry because just left over from my father's tools and things. So I was interested in boats and woodwork, as it were. And I still am. These are all model boats I've made, and the one in the window there.
I noticed them when I came in.
Yes, they're all made from... you would build a normal boat, only in miniature.
Did the generator shed go up according to plan?
Yes, very much so. I don't think we had little problem with... can't remember. It was a key on one of the flywheels. Nearly came off one day, but... No, it went well, but obviously a month or so later than was anticipated. It was well into the year before we actually got it up and running fully.
How was the soundproofing? Because the previous year, Bass had complained about the noise of the generator.
Well, yes, they were noisy generators. Listers, it was in a separate hut, which was had panelled walls. We really couldn't hear the engines in the base. Once the generator shed was put up, it was a separate building entirely from the base.
And was it generating power for the whole base or just for the...
No, for the whole base, right. Yeah.
There was a problem with flickering lights, wasn't there?
Yes. We had it for a long while, and Dave says that I cured it. I did notice that the V-rings, the drive wheels between the flywheel on the generator and the actual electric generator were vibrating. And I suggested to Dave that we take the tension off a bit, and that actually cured it eventually.
He tried several other alternative
remedies. Yes, they tried all sorts of things.
Swapping the flywheels over.
Yes, we did that. That caused us a problem because we didn't put one of them back in quite correctly, and it started wandering along the shaft. We were afraid it would come off and go straight out through the wall.
Like a hula hoop.
So and we decided, well, we could go and switch the generator off, but we'd have to go past this flywheel to get to it. So we worked out that the wheel would go that way, so we went the other side to turn it off while we... And I think eventually we had to have a new key made, I think the protector made a key to put in.
So once you had the generator shed and therefore the power you required, then your attention turned to... The scientific work?
Yes.
How much did you know about ionospherics when you went for the interview?
Well, only what it meant, and that, you know, the radio waves reflected from various layers in the ionosphere. And what they told me at the week's course I did at the radio research station.
Were you doing... the scientific work yourself?
Well, we collected data, and then it had to be interpreted to send the data back to the radio research station at Slough. On the, we send in the monthly statistics. That was things like the shape of the curve and the height and the various frequencies. Critical frequencies where it penetrates through each of the layers, and they all sent us a big A4 sheet of figures which were correlated horizontally and vertically to They were all sent to the radio, to the Inis Felix station in Stanley, and then forwarded on to Slough, where the data from all around the world went.
Was it being sent on paper or by Morse?
No, it was sent by Morse as rows and rows of figures, such that when they got it at the other end, they could cross-check that the totals were right, and then they'd come back and say, you know, you're too short on this column.
So take me through then what you were doing.
Well, once an hour we would... the machine would produce a strip of a film. It's about, I suppose, 4 inches wide, and depending on how many records were on it, 4 or 5 foot long. That had to be developed and printed. And then we would take measurements on it with overlays to measure the particular frequencies that the layers were penetrated. Mm. Virtually what you're doing is sending a radio wave straight up and listening for the echo back, but you've changed the frequencies as with time. It gets higher and higher and higher, and it penetrates through the different layers. So you finished it with a sort of horizontal line from the first layer, and then it will curve away because it's going further and further in, and then hit the next layer, and you measure the shape of this curve, and it's given a figure which is the frequency it goes through, the shape of the curve, etc. And that's where you get all the measurements to send the figures through.
Were you finding it interesting?
Oh, yes, it was quite time-consuming. 3 of us doing the interpretation on bass. Every 5th week you would be on cook. There were 5 of us on bass. Obviously, there's a diesel mech and a radio operator. And 3 of us on the iron sonde. But during the IGY, they used to have special world days where the records would come off every 15 minutes. And sometimes they would run it continuously for 10 minutes or something like that, depending on information coming in on sunspot activity. And we would get messages saying tomorrow's a special world day or that sort of thing. So sometimes when they're quarter hourly records, they all had to be processed and interpreted. And it was quite time-filling just for the 3 of us. Because later on, it was 2 of us doing it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you did.
Did you get any sense of the bigger global picture, or were you just doing your little thing and...
Well, we were aware that there were other people doing it. They were doing it in Port Stanley. They were doing it down at Halley Bay. I think there were some over on the other side, the New Zealand and Australians. And it was worldwide coverage of data for that period.
And were you kind of aware of the importance of the International Geophysical Year?
Well, yes. I mean, I had knew about previous sort of international years. Mm. And generally picked up some sort of picture.
So you felt it was an important thing to do?
Well, yes, certainly, yeah. And it was similar. I mean, it's light radar, it's echoes coming back. I mean, later in life I got 2 echoes going downwards.
Did it ever go wrong?
Oh, yes, quite often. Machine broke down and sometimes would burst into flames. And this is, you know, we had lots of spares. But I don't think we were off the air all that much because it was, I mean, we had the best generators possibly apart from Halley Bay within all the bases, because we needed 24-hour power, whereas other bases just put them on in the evenings for lighting and things.
Were you in touch with the other stations doing this work?
Yes, not the other radio stations, only Port Stanley, really, because they were sort of our immediate overseers. They normally were supposed to inform us of when the World Days were, but we in fact found communications direct. I think it's broadcast on some frequency, I can't remember. But we were aware when these days were coming up.
And that'll be through the night as well. There's a photograph in David's book of you at your desk in the wee small hours.
Well, that could have been midwinter, of course. It could be in the middle of the day. Often we would work through the night if we were getting behind with the developing the film and the interpretation.
This was all rather new to you, wasn't it, really?
It was. The techniques I'd obviously knew because of a radar sort of thing, but, I mean, it was new in terms of pure science, shall we say, yes.
Did you sense how can I put this without putting words in your mouth? Did it feel an exciting thing to be doing at the time?
Not unduly, no. I mean, it was the job. When you join FIDGE, you have to have an open mind. Otherwise, it's... I hadn't really realised that I was going to be cooking every fifth week.
And all the other chores.
Yes, and all the other chores, yes. Collecting snow and, emptying the toilets and...
There was a story about the toilets, wasn't there? There was a modification.
Yes. This goes to the year I left the base. We were visited by the stores officer from FIDS, and our toilet facilities were fairly crude at Lockroy. It was down at the end of the old generator shed, which was uninsulated, shall we say. And it was emptied into a bucket. I think it was an old cement fondue tin, which we had to empty probably fortnightly. In the middle of winter, it was fairly frozen contents, and it was often put on the stove to free it up before we emptied it. Anyway, the year I left, the stores officer was there, and he commented on this thing and said, I've got something better for you. I've got these sort of three-layer paper bags which you can dispose of. So I said, well, shall I put them on the stores list? Oh, yes, he said. What shall I put in? Because the stores list is pre-prepared, but these were new. So he said, well, just put them down as toilet bags. Anyway, the following year when I came back to the base on a summer trip, I got to the base and the base leader called me across and said, I've got to have a word with you. He said, what are all these? And he handed me a bag full of little 6-inch square rose-covered ladies' toilet bags. And obviously something had gone wrong in the stores, and they sent down 2 years' supply of these. I think we'd said we'd changed it once a fortnight, so we said we wanted 50 to do cover the 2 years. Anyway, they finished up with these 50 little ladies' toilet bags with roses on. I don't know what happened to them.
Where was it emptied?
Out at sea, or off the edge of the island.
Just anywhere?
Yes. I mean, what normally, that's how it was disposed of in those days.
So there wasn't much awareness of environmental issues?
No, the health and safety and that hadn't been invented, I don't think.
Your bass leader, Jim Muir-Smith,
yes,
became ill.
Yes, just before Christmas, he reported to the doctor that he wasn't feeling very well, had pain, and that was the doctor down at Base F.
Miss Jones?
Jones, yeah, David Jones. And Dave said we'll put him to bed on a slope. So we built a ramp on his bed, and then he reported to us when Jim wasn't on near the radio to say he suspected an appendix. So he was put to bed, and then we had to take the contents of his urine and look at it under a microscope and report what we found to Dave Jones on a daily basis.
By radio. Morse or voice?
No, that was voice. Interbass was voice.
So you were helping the doctor to diagnose the case, were you?
Well, yes. I mean, he was asking us questions of what we saw in under the microscope and say, oh, no, that's a bit of hair or that's a dirty slide or... I don't know quite what he was looking for, but he obviously knew what to expect. Fairly stressful because obviously took 20% of the...
Workforce
out of the picture, and was all made extra work, you know, looking after Jim, as it were.
Did you try and get a doctor to him?
Well, we did contact through SecFIDS base on the Danco coast, Admiralty Brown, I think it was called, and asked if Doc Jones couldn't get up because the Peltier Channel's frozen during the winter, and you can't travel between that and Lockroy because the water never totally freezes. There's a very strong current. And they'd said they could get across if it was necessary, and we started making arrangements for them to come across when they could. Which involved when they did set out, but got stranded at a Chilean base, I think. But we were trying to supply them with ice observations, which meant going up over the top of the glacier to look at the state of the ice at the north end of the Newmyre Channel, I think, and also across towards the Danco coast. So that would at times was a daily task, a lot of which Jack Tinbergen did. He would go off skiing up the glacier first thing in the morning to get a nice report for the day. So this is all extra
duty.
Work for what was basically a static base. We weren't no dogs, sledges or anything. It was all hand-hauled or hand-skied. Fortunately, the trip to the over the glacier up to see the north end of the Newmyre was reasonably straightforward. There wasn't any great crevasses or anything. The trip across through the gap to looking across to the Danco coast was, you had to do a 2-day, you had to camp out overnight.
How in the end did the Argentinians make it?
They stayed at the Chilean base for a while, and then they eventually came over one day. Unfortunately, even though we told them the ice was reasonable, it would blow into Lockroy Harbour. It was always coming down the Newmyre. If the wind changed, it would blow into the bay. So, in fact, they had to... we had radio contact with them, and they landed away from our island. We managed to pull their boat out and get them back to base. Went back the following morning expecting the boat to have gone, but it was, in fact, was still there. And we eventually got them and their boat back to base. And they had a supply of penicillin and stuff we'd run out of. But, I mean, prior to that, we'd had all sorts of things about with the doctor. Last resort, we would perhaps have to attempt to take the appendix out. So we discussed that we would try on the peso first to find out where all the bits were. You know, all sorts of ideas.
Did the Argentinian doctor confirm the diagnosis?
Yes, and Jim improved. And
because of the drugs?
Yes, we think so. They went back when the boat started coming south, but then Jim's condition would change depending on the news. You know, the Shackleton got held up and he seemed to turn for the worst, and then the Protector sent out a helicopter and didn't have enough range to get to us. Eventually a helicopter got in, they took him out, and I haven't seen or heard anything about him since, except he had his appendix out in Port Stanley, as I understand, and there was no problem.
And then you were left with four men on base?
Yes, for a while, yes.
Did anybody thank the Argentinians for their work?
Oh, yes, yes. And for some supplies they brought with them. No, they were nice guys, I'm sure. They were thanked by Sackfids and everybody.
You had to build a commode for Jim, didn't you?
Yes, we had to build a commode, and as I say, this ramp for his bed so he was lying at an angle. And of course,
that was to ease the pain?
No, just so he didn't have to go down the far end of the generator shed to the loo. Because it was it's quite a long
trek
down there through the old generator shed.
Yeah. So were you able to handle the extra responsibility, the extra work, not only nursing him but also doing his duties?
Well, yes, I think Jack and myself just got through the work. I mean, we just worked more, did more time, I guess. Some of our hobbies didn't get done, photography and the odd bit of skiing.
Were you exhausted?
Not unduly, I don't think. No, I don't recall being, well, we tired at times, but I don't, it had to be done.
Let's pause and
yeah.
I'll change the disc.
Right.